Kia ora koutou. Welcome to the New Zealand General Practice Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Joe Scott Jones. Earlier seasons of this podcast focused on joint practice. This season is an opportunity to listen in on monthly conversations I have with Dr. Dave Mapleston, organised for the Pinnacle GP Network. Dave shares insights into important clinical changes he picks up in his reading as a part-time GP and advisor to the Health and Disability Commissioner. I hope you enjoy. Kia ora, Dave. We're here again for another Clinical Snippets. Looking forward to it. Do you want to introduce yourself?
Yeah, kia ora tato. Dave Mapleston, very part-time GP, keen on keeping my colleagues informed on little bits and pieces that might go under or over the radar with the huge workloads that they have.
Bon vivant and intellectual giant, in my opinion, Dave. So I'm looking forward to clinical snippets for May 2023.
Yeah, May 2023.
Apologies for listeners for the delay in publishing April's, by the way, just while I've got you, but both will come out very soon.
So should we head off with the pelvis?
Yeah.
And this is pelvic mesh complications. So Te Whatuora now have a service for, they call it female pelvic mesh complications. So I think you males with complaining about pelvic mesh and their hernias aren't covered, but it's a national service for women who may have been harmed by mesh related to treatment of urinary stress incontinence or pelvic organ prolapse. So the Te Whatuora website, and I've got links on these in the snippets, are now providing a really comprehensive service with access to a multidisciplinary team, which might include things like continence care, chronic pain management, counselling and surgery. Services are available in Auckland and Christchurch, and transportation and accommodation assistance may be available to your patients. And there's a specific e-referral form for access to the service. And that was discussed in the recent e-referrals newsletter. But the Te Whatuora website's worth looking at just in terms of all the information that's involved there, including video on the service. So you can direct your patients there, but also quite handy to look at yourself at what might be available for patients. I presume a lot of these will have ACC claims for treatment injury, although they may not, but that's also worth considering. If you have a patient with chronic pain or chronic disability related to mesh implant.
Good. Reduction in postcode access to care. As you say, I think men who are having problems with mesh or feel they're having problems with mesh in their hernia operation will still be able to get that treatment injury support through ACC. But I have to say, I haven't come across anybody or any real discussion about it. Is it something you've come across in your HDC work?
Oh yeah, I see complaints about pain post inguinal hernia repair, particularly if mesh has been used, is quite commonly. But in fact, the figures for post herniorrhaphy pain, whether it's with the mesh has been used or not, are actually quite significant. Over 20%, I think. Yeah,
20%. Wow.
I think over 20% from memory, but. So it's always difficult to say this was just a consequence of the surgery, not related to mesh, or whether the mesh was specifically involved.
Wow.
But it's much easier to get the mesh out of a hernia than it is out of the pelvis, female pelvis. So that's always an option.
So is that 20% of people who've had mesh involved with their surgery complaining of pain, or 20% of patients who've had a hernia operation have significant pain after the surgery?
Yep, that's of the hernia surgery.
Not
specifically mesh.
Wow.
I think it was, I can't remember the exact figure, but it was certainly very significant.
Yeah, I got it.
That's not unusual. Certainly in the, in that sort of 3 to 6 month period, a lot of them will resolve, but you know, there is a significant proportion of they get ongoing pain.
Right, okay.
Sometimes related to nerve entrapment and those sorts of things. So assuming we're talking about hernias, let's talk about prostates. Mm-hmm. So the second topic is just PSA testing, that dreaded thing that comes up periodically. So GP Research Review, the second issue for 2023, comments on the Urological Society of Australia and New Zealand position statement on PSA testing, which is being regarded as an interim document prior to updating of the 2015 guidelines, which they believe are now updated. So the recommendations include ensure prostate cancer awareness amongst men and counsel them on the potential risks and benefits of PSA testing. Which makes sense. Again, I don't, you know, does that mean that we need to be targeting all males within a specific age group and proactively informing them? Is that our role, or are we still opportunistically discussing it when they come in for...
Yeah, I sort of read it as a population activity rather than a you know, but anyway, the it's not to ignore the conversation. I read it if it comes up, so which, you know, so a bit of motherhood and apple pie, really.
Yeah, I guess the difficulty I have, particularly if there's a complaint from somebody who says, you know, my doctor never talked to me about PSA testing and now I've got prostate cancer, is deciding, well, should, you know, he never asked about it, but should it have been brought up proactively at some stage? And the pressure changes in guidance might put on us as providers to change the way we're doing things. But other recommendations include offering an individualized risk-adapted strategy for early detection of prostate cancer in men aged greater than 50 years of age with a life expectancy of at least 10 years.
So that's saying, you know, unless you're very frail at 50 or got other issues that are going on, then we should be raising it and having a risk adapted strategy.
That would be my interpretation. So in terms of risk, offer early PSA testing to men at increased risk of prostate cancer. So that's those with a family history, men over 45 with a family history, men of high risk ethnicities, including Indigenous men greater than 45 years of age, and men carrying the BRCA2 mutations should be screened from over 40 years of age.
Yeah. They use the term Indigenous because it's an Australia-New Zealand guideline. Yeah. I think that's why that term.
It covers both countries. Stop early diagnosis of prostate cancer based on limited life expectancy and poor performance status. So that again comes back to males with a life expectancy of less than 10 years who are unlikely to benefit. Yeah. And for men with an initial PSA of greater than 3, the use of risk stratification, considering all these factors, age, family history, DRE result, PSA density, which can help guide the need for further testing, including MRI and biopsy.
Although it was really interesting, the BRCA2 mutation thing was really interesting. So, you know, if you've got a strong family history of pancreatic cancer or breast cancer, and you're male, then you know, it's worthwhile considering asking for a BRCA2 test to be done. I thought that was quite. Oh, obviously a prostate cancer. You know, who of us have had a BRCA2? Test done, and how do we access that was one of the questions that arose for me.
Yeah, because I think historically, well, from patients I've seen that have been referred, we have inevitably been women with strong family history of breast cancer, and I can't recall the brothers ever being invited to or recommended that the males have the testing done as well.
But I think we probably should. And certainly if I've got any of our brothers who've had breast cancer, then we should definitely consider it. The other thing with this is that I thought was really interesting is the MRI and biopsy, that one of the things that's changing, previously a biopsy was not exactly random, but the prostate's a fairly big organ compared to the size of the end of a needle. They do multiple biopsies when they do, you're having your biopsy done. So there's increases the chance of actually picking up the cancer, but you've also got a fairly good chance of missing the significant cancer within your prostate. Whereas an MRI guided, an MRI before the biopsy, and then an ultrasound guided biopsy into the site where the MRI has suggested the cancer is sitting, increases the accuracy of the biopsy significantly. And that impacts then on whether you have on the outcome of a generalized screening program. So, you know, it's those things that are changing that are potentially changing the goalposts as to whether a formal screening program is worthwhile or not.
Yeah. I mean, I can see this all this edging towards a formal screening program, but interestingly, last week in the BMJ, a panel of urologists published a push against the type of screening that we're perhaps heading towards. I think in Europe, there's pressure on to get a Europe-wide formal screening program in place, although the only two countries in the world that have government-supported population-based screening programs for prostate cancer at the moment are Lithuania and Kazakhstan.
Right, okay.
But that was based... but essentially, they were saying that the way things are at the moment there in the UK, which is similar to here, which is the sort of opportunistic patient information discussion and proceeding with PSA if the patient's in agreement, has essentially led to far more harm than good, including increase in inequity. So you tend to get the more educated patients and generally older patients getting their PSA done and treatment when they're really not the shouldn't be the target.
Yeah, well, we definitely see that here as well. You know, Maori men more likely to die from complicated prostate cancer and less likely to have screening done. I'm personally leaning towards, I know the Prostate Cancer Foundation are lobbying at the moment to have a pilot done looking at the European screening guidelines and seeing whether they would work here in New Zealand. And I'm definitely leaning towards that, having attended their conference last week just by chance. I learned more about prostate cancer than I realized I didn't know.
Always worth keeping up with.
But this is going to make that when people complain about prostate, is this going to make your job a bit harder, sort of trying to work through what the guidelines actually say?
Yeah. Well, I think we've still got international evidence or international tendencies which are generally against a formal screening program.
Right.
So I think, you know, I can say, well, look, you know, perhaps local guidance wasn't followed necessarily, but you know, if it's still internationally accepted that you don't have a formal conversation with every 50 plus year old that comes into the waiting room, then that could be regarded as acceptable practice.
So this is a position statement, and they're looking to change the current guidelines.
Yep.
But the guidelines in New Zealand haven't yet changed.
That's right. So the 2015 guidances are still what I would regard as being a basis for accepted management.
Yeah. Okay.
And the health pathways are largely in accordance with what's in the 2015 guidance still.
Yeah. But changes are coming.
And changes are coming, absolutely.
I read this and I thought I'm going to feel a lot happier about organising a PSA for people. There's also the ongoing debate about whether a digital rectal examination is, how much value it adds.
Again, the stuff I've read more recently seems to be edging more and more away from the fact that it adds anything particularly useful to the screening. So let's move away from the prostate to treating the elderly with lots of pills.
Close to my heart, this one.
this has just come out of a New Zealand study published in the Journal of Primary Healthcare with a focus on polypharmacy, where 61 indicators for inappropriate medicines prescribing in polypharmacy relevant to people aged over 65 were identified, and now form what they've called the New Zealand criteria. And these were indicators that were considered very important or important in New Zealand, and were actually very similar to studies or research done overseas on similar issues. So the medicines that were identified as being a particular concern included NSAIDs, benzos, anticholinergics, antipsychotics, and first-generation antihistamines. And the identification of drugs or drug combinations used in the table were done by the Delphi method, so getting concordance amongst the experts. And the two indicators got 100% consensus were a combination of three or more CNS active medicines, so antidepressants, antipsychotics, antiepileptics, benzos, zobaclone, opioids, and the use of long-acting sulfonylureas such as glibenclamide. And again, you know, in all the notes that I see, particularly rest home notes, I would have to say that a combination of three or more CNS active medicines being prescribed is not at all unusual. And certainly would be a basis for looking closely and deprescribing. Other interesting combinations that got quite high up the list of those to be looked at and hopefully deprescribed: alpha blockers in the elderly with postural hypotension, tricyclics or quetiapine for sleep, persistence of strong opioids and acute pain, which again we see not uncommonly, multiple antihypertensives and frailty. So it's probably actually worth digging out this article and just having a look at the medicines and combinations that they've been examining.
That is very interesting. I mean, it might be a good quality project for practices to look at. You know, the older patients with heart failure and NSAIDs or COX-2 inhibitors.
I mean, the triple whammy, I think we're highly aware of, but a lot of these other ones you wouldn't necessarily think about. So, but there's a really good article, 2018 BPAC article on deprescribing, which gives a list of resources that can be useful if you are deprescribing for the elderly. And it talks about the medicines therapy assessment, pharmacist-led medicines therapy assessment, which is available in some areas at least.
Fantastic.
It can be helpful. Still on prescribing, just new COPD guidance. So these are the GOLD, recently published GOLD, updated guidelines on COPD. Most interesting changes that a LABA-LAMA combination treatment is now recommended as first line in patients requiring a long-acting bronchodilator. So going straight to LABA-LAMA combination, including those who are more symptomatic or at high exacerbation risk. So that supersedes the previous guidance, which was to use LAMA or LABA monotherapy first.
Right.
So a bit more of an aggressive approach.
Does Pharmac allow us to do that?
No.
Okay.
So that which is mentioned in the BPAC updated guidance. Or it's not updated guidance yet. The comment was that we will await any revision of New Zealand guidance in accordance with the GOLD 2023 report, because that will require a change in special authority criteria. At the moment, a patient needs to be stabilised on LAMA monotherapy first before you can give a LABA-LAMA combination, although you can still prescribe two separate inhalers.
Right.
Presumably, but I guess that you then get the issue with compliance. Use of a steroid and LABA alone is now discouraged throughout COPD management, unless prescribed for a concurrent diagnosis such as asthma, and a much more targeted approach for inhaled corticosteroid use is suggested.
So this was previously they'd said not to use an ICS if unless somebody had eosinophilia, I think, because there was a high risk of higher risk of exacerbations and recurring infections if you use.
That's right, community acquired pneumonia. Yeah. So I think they're just pushing that again, even more specifically now. And the ABCD assessment tool is now ABE. I did have that up here, but maybe I haven't got it anymore. No, and that's really just around, just around the exacerbations, particularly. I think it's just to simplify management, but the what used to be group C and D is now group E, which is just equal to or more than two moderate exacerbations, or one or more hospitalized exacerbations per year, puts you into group E with slightly different management recommendations. So that's really just it's out there if you want to go hunting for it, but the BPAC has yet to update their previous useful tools and guidance to reflect this. And I think they're waiting for a change in the PharmAC access criteria.
Fantastic. That's great. I'm just in the process of developing a respiratory dashboard. It's a feedback useful data about respiratory management to our practices, and talking to other PHOs around introducing that as well. And so you've just made me need to revise the work that I've made the last 3 months, Dave. Thank you very much.
Well,
I'm so pleased that we had this conversation.
Talking about dashboards, I know we've got a diabetes dashboard as well, but I just want to push the Taka Haringa EPIC dashboard again, and yeah, this time related to type 2 diabetes prescribing. So this came out, the latest issue of Diabetes and Obesity Research Review looked at a Dutch study related to SGLT2 or empagliflozin here use in very high cardiovascular risk patients with type 2 diabetes. Mm-hmm. And even though the drug's been freely available in Holland for, I think, at least a year longer than New Zealand, only 10.3% of patients who were eligible and their national guidelines were actually being prescribed the medications. And of those not prescribed the medication, there was no contraindication to prescribing in over 70%, and none of those were on a GLP-1 agonist as well. So I think there's extremely useful practical algorithms for management of type 2 diabetes in the NZSSD website. But the I think we're doing much better based on, yeah, on my look at the Te Aka Haringa stuff. So, and also not so much of an equity issue either. I think that looks to be well addressed with prescribing in New Zealand. So the dashboard shows nationally about 16.8% of patients diagnosed with diabetes are Māori, 51% non-Māori. But looking at the diabetes medicines prescribed by ethnic group, there's extremely equitable prescribing going on, which probably relates in part to the PharmAC access criteria. So again, you can look at this, you can compare the national prescribing with your own prescribing and your practice prescribing on the website, which also scores you points for your Te Whanaki patient outcomes CME, so it can be quite useful. So essentially, looking at the national data, it seemed to me that there was generally good equitable prescribing and far better than this Dutch study. Interestingly though, if we look at diabetes treatment and intensification of treatment generally, our Asian population tended to have a sort of quite obviously less intensification of treatment compared with other ethnicities.
Yeah,
I'm not sure the reason for that. So 52.9% of Asians diagnosed with diabetes were on a single medicine, compared to around 40 to 45% of other groups, and only just over 20% were on insulin, compared to around 35% of other ethnicities. So it's an interesting picture. I'm not sure of the reasons for that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's the pro-equity prescribing guidance from and eligibility from PharmAC, particularly around the SGLT1 and the other ones. The GLP L1, whatever, I was getting mixed up. So which may be having that impact, but it's definitely something that's the Heiaka Hiranga dashboard shows really clearly, doesn't it? And it'd be really interesting for practices to look at their own practice breakdown to see whether they've, and it's that it's things that are happening unconsciously as well. You know, the, so there's a all sorts of structural issues that'll lead to those sorts of figures, particularly looking at ethnicity. You know, is it an access issue? Is it a because we're following the pro-equity guidance, etc. It's sort of unless you shine a light on it, you don't realize.
That's right. So I think just looking at knowing what your figures are, of course, enables you then to recognize that whether it might be inequities and to focus on them. But the other interesting area where there was inequity or a difference between non-Māori, non-Pacific, and Māori and Pacific is around medicines possession reflecting adherence to the prescribed regime. So poor possession, which was described as the patients having less than 6 months of supply during the previous 12 months, being prescribed less than 6 months of supply during the previous 12 months, Māori, Pacific, and Asian were around 25% of patients, interestingly, whereas European other were just under 20%. So again, the prescribing is one part of the equation. The taking, of course, is the other important part of the equation. Yeah. And I'm not sure how easy it is to identify within our practices those patients that aren't getting their prescriptions when they should be, to see what barriers are there that are stopping them from adhering to the regime.
Yeah, well, we're actually starting to work on that, looking at the dispensing data as well as the prescribing data. We're starting to get some access to that, so more to come on that. But the good thing about the dashboards that the PHOs can produce is that you can identify the individual patients who are involved in these, where these gaps are, so that you can actually recall them and bring them in. The Te Ako Hiranga gives you, or He Ako Hiranga brings the population level, but it's actually
the individual.
Who can you actually draw those? Can you draw those people in?
So you're certainly pushing for the Pinnacle dashboard, for applying, I guess, what you learn looking at the other figures. But just on diabetes, still to stay, recent Goodfellow Gem looked at a study suggesting vitamin D might reduce the risk of diabetes and pre-diabetes. Looked at three trials, quite large numbers, and basically reported a reduction of overall of 3% in absolute risk of progression to diabetes. And these were using doses of 80,000 units four weekly and 120,000 units four weekly. New Zealand options 50,000 units per month or four weekly, which is a single 1.25 milligram cholecalciferol tablet per month. I guess you could take two of them, would be 100,000 units four weekly. So there was an improvement with higher blood levels of vitamin D, with the greatest reduction when the blood level was greater than 125 nanomoles per liter, and that resulted in 18% absolute risk reduction. There weren't any obvious adverse effects, but the studies weren't powered to detect these. But I'll just put in the warning that vitamin D is fat soluble and can be toxic in overdose, although usually you need serum levels greater than 375 nanomoles per liter to get the toxic effects. So well above the 125 nanomoles per liter that were giving the best risk reduction from pre-diabetes to diabetes. But from a practical level, number needed to treat to prevent diabetes is 30, compared with 7 for intensive lifestyle and 14 with metformin. So it might be an adjunct, but it's certainly not not a panacea as a single intervention.
Yeah, I don't know. Vitamin D is one of those ones that I get little shivers down my spine when I read about vitamin D, a bit like vitamin C, and
Everything.
Good for everything.
Aspirin.
Yeah. The I see there's a course coming up in Waikato in July as well for diabetes education. It may be an opportunity to. I wonder if they'll cover some of these pre-diabetes prevention. I'm particularly interested in how many people with pre-diabetes actually do go on to develop diabetes. If they've shown a 3% absolute risk reduction of progression, If I have pre-diabetes, I have heard that it's a sort of 2-3% risk of developing diabetes each year. If you're in that category, and obviously a higher risk the closer you are to 50. I wonder about pre-diabetes as a, I hate the term pre-diabetes because it labels people with the disease that they don't have.
Yep. And I think that has become an issue. I had a complaint the other day from somebody who had been labeled, had HbA1c of 41, which is pre-diabetes by the definitions we use. And this had adversely affected their application for life insurance.
Yeah.
And they'd had it, they'd gone on a diet, had it repeated, and it was 37. And they were wanting the doctor, the doctor was refusing to remove it from the medical file.
Mm-hmm.
So it raises a bit of a dilemma. That I had to say, well, look, you know, they're right. It is, you know, it was right to put this diagnosis in the notes because the criteria were fulfilled. But there are real implications in that. But the diabetes management course, University of Waikato and New Zealand Society or NZSSD, there's a free online diabetes management course starting 17th of July. It's run over 20 weeks, 8 30-minute webinars and 8 30-minute case discussion and mentoring sessions. And it's approved for 16 hours of CME. So if you have anyone that's interested or staff that are interested, 17th of July 2023 is the starting date.
We've had such good feedback. They've run this before and it's such good feedback from it. People find it, you know, transformative. Strongly advocate for that.
Just another push again for topiramate in pregnancy. So MedSafe have put out another alert.
Not for topiramate in pregnancy.
No, that's right. Not for using it. But the alert just around the use of it in pregnancy and women of childbearing age. So it definitely causes congenital malformations and neurodevelopmental disorders. And the advice to health professionals is it should only be used to treat epilepsy in pregnancy if the potential benefit justifies a potential risk to the mother and fetus. Refer epileptic women taking topiramate who become or plan to become pregnant for specialist advice. The use of topiramate for migraine prophylaxis is contraindicated in pregnancy. Before you start treatment with topiramate, make sure the patient's not pregnant, so perform pregnancy test. And women of childbearing potential on topiramate should be using a highly effective contraceptive method during treatment and need to be informed of the childbearing, of the risks of potential risks of fetal harm if they become pregnant. So I think we would be initiating it for migraine prophylaxis, maybe. I can't think much of what else we'd be using it for, but.
I worry about this because I'm sure there are people out there who started on topiramate years and years ago, and this has now become apparent. I can't remember what the pregnancy advice would have been, you know, 10, 15 years ago. I'm hoping that the message has really got out in terms of people starting it now, but it's those people who have been on it for a little while, and whether they're having the medication reviews and this is actually being raised and you know, people are being advised around it.
I think really important, because the information has been out there for us, and if your patient gets pregnant and has to have a termination and complains and says, I was never told about the risk, you know, it puts you in a potentially unstable position, and often you won't have necessarily documented. But this is something I think, if you talk about it, document it for sure.
Absolutely, it's not so much the complaint, but the impact for family, and you know,
absolutely. And again, update on progestogen only contraception and risk of breast cancer. So,
which is perfectly safe. We have no side effects whatsoever.
That's right. You can use it freely. But a recently published study based in the UK now suggests the risk of developing breast cancer in patients who take progestogen only contraceptives is comparable to those taking combined oral contraceptives. So this just, I guess, new information coming out with more up-to-date studies. So it's recommended, or the FSRH, which is the UK-based Faculty of Sexual and Reproductive Health Care, haven't made any changes to their recommendations in response to the study. But there is a best practice tip that's come out, which is the absolute risk of breast cancer with progesterone-only contraceptive use is still very small, especially in younger patients with no familial breast cancer risk. And the decision to prescribe any type of hormonal contraception should consider this low risk in the context of the possible benefits, e.g. reduced risk of an unplanned pregnancy and other non-contraceptive benefits, such as reducing the risk of endometrial and ovarian cancers. So essentially, I think it's about being aware and having that conversation with the patient so they're making an informed choice.
The and the risk is extremely small. And so there's, I'm trying to think what the figures were when you start, if under the age of 16 and you take it for more than 5 years, there's a, so you increase the risk of lifetime risk of breast cancer is 1 in 12, and the risk doesn't increase to, you know, 1 in 11 or 1 in 10. It's a, you know, 1 in 11.9 or something. It's
like one in a thousand or something along those lines. I guess the patients I'd be maybe have some concern are those that have been prescribed, those with history, personal history of breast cancer that have been prescribed Mini-Pill, because it was felt that the combined oral contraceptive wasn't appropriate for them, and whether we should be seeking the breast surgeon's advice in those patients.
So that's a slightly different take on it, isn't it? This is about, presumably this is about breast cancer arising de novo.
You might think if it's shown no difference, but you know, because historically we would be cautious about using any estrogen containing.
Absolutely.
So if the progestogen can be equally potentially harmful, I guess we just need to consider it.
But as I say, it's complicated, Dave.
Yeah, there's no formal direction that's come out of the UK, at least at this stage. So, and just as I fiddle in my chair to round things off, prescribing for ADHD, which I'm sure most of us are seeing happening.
I thought you were going back to the prostate conversation again. That was an ADHD reference. Okay.
I was just losing concentration for a while. Pharmax announced from the 1st of June, where you can prescribe 3 months of methylphenidate or dexamphetamine in one hit, but it will still be dispensed monthly to the patient. But they won't have to contact us every month to get another script.
Which is good.
And just as a kind of an adjunct to that, the Australian New Zealand College of Psychiatrists has a statement on guidance for the use of stimulant medications in adults. It's a 2015 guidance, but it just talks about the precautions, particularly in adult prescribing, and include things such as a baseline ECG should be performed if there's a family history of serious cardiac disease or sudden death in young family members or abnormal finding on cardiac examination. I'm just, you know, I see an increasing number of patients commenced on prescribed methylphenidate after an online consultation with a psychiatrist. I find it difficult to think how can that happen without appropriate pre-treatment screening. New Zealand formulary recommends prior to initiation of methylphenidate, obtain your detailed psychiatric history, assess for risk of misuse, including family and caregivers. So I presume that means if your son's a meth addict, then maybe you shouldn't be prescribed methylphenidate if he's living with you. Assess for personal family history of tics or Tourette's, assess cardiovascular function, including blood pressure and heart rate, and seek specialist cardiac advice if there's a history of or current cardiovascular disease, measure height and weight, and assess for family history of sudden cardiac or unexplained death or malignant arrhythmia. So that's pre-treatment screening. And then there are monitoring recommendations, which essentially are monitoring for any emergence or deterioration of pre-existing of psychiatric disorders or tics, monitoring for misuse, monitoring cardiovascular status, including blood pressure and heart rate at least every 6 months and at every dose adjustment, assessing weight and appetite at least every 6 months, closely monitoring patients at risk of acute angle closure glaucoma, monitor full blood count and platelet counts during prolonged therapy as clinically indicated. So I'm not quite sure whether that means if you start bruising, do it, or do it anyway, but consider a D challenge at least once yearly. So in some ways, it's quite handy to have these monitoring requirements because, again, I get complaints from patients on methylphenidate who I get really annoyed that they have to go back to see their doctor every 6 months or so to get a repeat script and just say, you know, why can't I just get it when I ask for it? And I think as long, you know, that there is a reason for these at least 6 monthly reviews and at the time of prescribing, the patient should be aware that, yes, there will be monitoring required. But probably most importantly is there is monitoring required.
Yeah, it gives us a clear guide as to what we should be doing with the in the medication reviews, which, you know, this is particularly for adults. Is there similar guidance for adolescents?
Around the psychiatric side of things, definitely. And I think cardiovascular monitoring, I didn't look into the NGCF specifically. But the pre-treatment stuff is certainly similar in terms of family history of arrhythmias, those sorts of things.
With the change in prescribing, then it's a good opportunity to sit back and just, you know, have a look through the formulary again. You're again just going back to that prostate foundation conference that I went to. You don't know what you don't know. And if you think you know everything about methylphenidate, maybe this is an opportunity to step back and have a look at the formulary after listening to the clinical snippets and educate yourself, perhaps.
That's it. That's a bit of a long one today, but there's lots of stuff coming in from all sources.
Awesome, Dave. I mean, I think it's you've covered pelvic mesh, PSA, guidance around polypharmacy. There was the new COPD guidelines. Type 2 diabetes and vitamin D potentially in pre-diabetes. It's really important to keep reminding us about the topiramate in pregnancy. I'm really surprised about the progesterone-only contraception and the risk of breast cancer. Need to find out more about that. And prescribing in ADHD as well. So, I mean, that's a fantastic cover of a really wide range of topics. Once again, Dave, thank you so much.
Thank you, and hopefully I haven't stressed everybody out, but remember the breathing exercises from the last session.
Yes. All right, kakite.
You're right.
Thanks for listening. Please like and share this podcast if you found it useful. The show notes on the podcast website contain links to all the resources that we discussed. A video version of this podcast is available on the Pinnacle Practice website at pinnacle.co.nz. Kakite Ano.